This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Hi, hello everyone. Hi. Just two notes before we start. First of all, after the film, I'm sure you're going to want to engage more with some of the teachings of Rabbi Cardozo, and he has kindly set up a number of essays that you can take right on the bima behind me, as well as there's a sign-up sheet for his weekly newsletters. Also, if you can't see the screen right after the introduction, they're going to start simultaneously playing it on a different screen in the lunchroom, so you can watch it in either place and then come back here for the interview. Yeah, we're going to move the lectern. hello, everyone. My name is Yehuda Salamont, and I've had the honor to be a part of the Pardes community for over 18 years as the son of Deborah Weiner. The Gemara at the end of Masechet Makot recounts the following story. Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah, Rabbi Yeshua, and Rabbi Akiva were walking towards Jerusalem. When they reached Mount Scopus and gazed at the ruins of the temple, they tore their clothing. When they arrived at the Temple Mount, they saw a fox running out of the area where the Holy of Holies had been, and they began to cry, while Rabbi Akiva laughed. The story continues with Rabbi Akiva presenting a masterful commentary of the text of a verse in Isaiah. He argues that if the prophecies of destruction had been fulfilled, the prophecies of renewal must be true. Rabbi Akiva engaged with an ancient text and found what had been lost, a new creative interpretation. The story culminates with the rabbi saying in unison, "Akiva, you have comforted us. Akiva, you have comforted us." For the past few years, I have been struggling with the reality that my knowledge of God was no more sophisticated than a second grader. A feeling of existential anxiety that enveloped me as I thought about what would happen to the laws of Shabbat in a fully automated world, or kashrut with lab-grown parv pork chops. I live in perpetual state of disappointment from leaders who seem to never miss an opportunity to say the wrong thing. If any of these feelings resonate with you, I assure you, you have come to the right place. The words of the rabbis above are apt. Akiva, you have comforted us. Not Akiva, you have solved our problems. Akiva, you're a miracle worker. Akiva, you are right. Nothing has actually changed. The temple was not rebuilt, and it is still not. But these rabbis sought comfort on what the future might hold. Akiva's words resound today despite his tragic end. The Gemara in Tanit writes, when Rabbi Akiva beheld Bar Kochva, he exclaimed, "He is the King Messiah." Rabbi Yochanan ben Torta responded, "Akiva, grass will be growing out of your cheeks, and the Messiah will not have come." And indeed, Akiva did not live to see the Messiah come or the temple be rebuilt. Yes, his words of comfort echo through these halls and have been repeated by thousands of scholars throughout the ages. That is the beauty of Rabbi Cardozo's work. It is not the mystical promise of a New Age philosopher or the simplistic answers of outreach. Rabbi Cardozo's life work is a call to action for all of us to reach beyond our comfortable limits, engage with text, discover creativity, and encounter God where he is. We're a movie spoiler-averse culture, so I'll stop here and we can pick this up after the screening. But I'm just going to introduce Rabbi Cardozo. He is an author, educator, and philosopher of halakha who defies classification. Born in Holland a year after the Holocaust in a secular home with a Christian mother and Jewish father, Rabbi Cardozo converted to Judaism by himself as a teenager. He spent 12 years learning in ultra-Orthodox Haredi yeshiva and received Heter Hora rabbinic ordination from Rabbi Aryeh Leib Gerwitz, Rosh HaYeshiva of Gateshead, the Lakewood or Mir of England. Rabbi Cardozo and his wife Freda moved to Jerusalem 40 years ago and have lived in the Jerusalem neighborhood of Bayit Vagan since their aliyah. Rabbi Cardozo is the founder and dean of the David Cardozo Academy and the Beit Midrash of Avraham Avinu in Jerusalem. He's the author of 13 books and numerous articles with a primary focus on finding new halachic and philosophical approaches to dealing with the crisis of religion and identity amongst Jews and the Jewish state of Israel. The documentary you're about to see is titled Lonely But Not Alone, The Story of a Rebellion. It's 40 minutes long, and we'll pick up with a deeper discussion about Rabbi Cardozo's life and his unique approach to halakha and Jewish philosophy after the screening. Now, Rabbi Cardozo just wants to say a few things of introduction.
Thank you very much, Yehuda. Also, much thanks to Deborah and to Rabbi David Kruse-Levin. Not sure where he is, but thanks to Pardes for giving me the opportunity to show this movie documentary to you. Can you hear me? No. Talk louder into the...
It's very low.
Okay. I just need for a few minutes to introduce this movie so that you will understand it. First of all, on a practical level, be aware that all of it is in English. Besides a few moments when I'm speaking with my brother in Dutch. But on the film itself, there is a subtitle, all of it in English. So I hope you can all see that here on the screen. Especially for those who are not so good in their Dutch or who do not understand my English pronunciation of this foreign language to me. I must warn you a little bit about this movie, because it is quite unusual. I can't even say that I'm happy with it, but I think it is an important message which I'm trying here to convey. As you just heard before, I hail from Amsterdam, born in 1946 of a mixed marriage. I converted when I was 16 years old. However, I always thought, and so does my brother who will appear in this movie, we always thought that we were Jewish, only later to find out that we were not. And I decided then, after a lot of struggle, to make the move and make Giur. I do not see myself at all in these terms, because I always considered myself to be Jewish, but from an halachic perspective, that has to be done. My mother also converted when she was about 50 years old. My father was a very, very proud Jew. I never understood why he married a non-Jewish woman, but the answer to that is that my mother was completely raised within a Jewish environment in Amsterdam, had lost her parents very early in her life, moved in with the parents of my father, after which many years later in 1939 they got married. But she was completely part of that world, including even all the Jewish expressions. And she also considered herself to be Jewish, knowing that she came from Christian parents. My brother nearly converted, but on the end decided not to do so. And you will see some moments which are highly emotional about my discussion with him about some of the things which happened by us at home, because on the end of the day, he was the only non-Jew left in our family, which created very unusual situations, and some of them are quite embarrassing now that I'm looking back to it, but you can ask me about that later on. I wrote, after this movie, I wrote a booklet, which you have can find here on the Bima, Lonely But Not Alone, by the same title. And I just want you to know that really you should, forgive me for saying so, see this movie a few times, because there are several layers to it which you won't be able to catch the first time. If you want, we can always make it available to you by internet or whatever it is. But be aware of it. There's a lot of stuff there which had to be put into 45 minutes, which really needs a discussion of many, many hours. It also reflects my personal thinking about the Jewish tradition, which I often feel is no longer connected with the reality in which we live. I believe that in the halachic world, definitely certain things need to change to inspire people, to make it possible for us to live a full Jewish life, especially in this country. And therefore, I want you to know there are some people who would consider me an apikores, an heretic, and also people would say that I'm much too religious. I leave it up to you to decide which one of these two are actually true. But anyway, keep an eye on this movie. As I said before, it is a little disturbing. It is a little unusual. I hope you can hear well. You can read well the text. And if you want afterwards, we can have a discussion about some of the different issues which come up within that movie. Toda rabba. Thank you very much.
Rabbi Cardozo, thank you. The film was excellent. I'm going to start with the question I think everyone wants to know. Would you drink the wine today?
No,
they're both working.
Oh, the
both
better. Okay. The answer is yes. I will not drink wine which is made by anti-Semitic people, by self-hating Jews, by people who have lost all moral standards. And I want the wine to be made by Jews because I believe there's a certain sanctity, especially for the Jewish people. But if a non-Jew like my brother would touch it, I would definitely drink it, and I've done so in the past. I feel very bad about what happened at our home at the time. This was purely because being brought up in this world, I thought that this was the end of the law and there was nothing to be done about it. And I want you to know that Mark Shapiro, is the famous Mark Shapiro, brings many examples in his latest book where he shows that poskim, halachic authorities, especially in Italy, used to use non-Jewish wine made by non-Jews for making kiddush. So the story is definitely different from what we have normally been taught.
So I'm gonna take a step back and go back to your biography for a moment. You write that in many ways, an unusual birth. Your mother had a difficult birthing experience, and being the child of a mixed marriage have set the stage for my life. I often see things from a reverse position. What is normal for others evokes in me feelings of wonder and awe, and what others consider amazing, I see as obvious. As the product of a mixed marriage who converted to Judaism at the age of 16, I became somewhat of an in-outsider. So can you tell us a little bit more about your biography and some examples of what others consider amazing that are obvious and others consider obvious that is amazing?
I think that since the days that this film was made, which, by the way, was started many, many years ago, and I should mention, which I forgot to mention at the beginning of the film was made by Willy Lindwer, who is a very famous documentary maker in Holland. He's living now here. He is very well known for the last 4 months of Anne Frank in the concentration camps, and he has an international reputation. And being a very close friend of mine, and when I was asked to make this movie, I asked him to do so. He knew the background. He understood the Dutch background. He understood me because we knew each other for many years. And I can't thank him enough for that. By now, I must say that there is nothing at all anymore which I take for granted. Things which perhaps in the past I did, I no longer do. I turned 2 weeks ago 70 years old. And the more I become older or younger, the more I realize that life is a complete and total mystery. When I see my great-grandchildren, when they are born a few minutes after the great moment took place, I would love to have a conversation with them and ask them, "Nu, what do you think about this place?" Because the child which is born and just enters this world, coming somewhere from something else, from another place, must be so overwhelmed by what is taking place now in front of its eyes, what it hears, what it sees, that everything will become a total amazement. The problem is that just by the time that you're able to speak, you're already used to it. And that's exactly the trick, and that's exactly the challenge here. I often try to imagine my life starting at this very hour, this very moment, and asking myself, is there anything to be taken for granted? Did science give any answer to any of the big questions which we asked? Did religion really answer all these questions? And all of them is, no, they didn't. We are living with a question which can ultimately not be answered. the big issue in life, in my opinion, is, and that I think is one of the big functions of the Jewish tradition, is how do you live with a question which gets never answered?
That's exactly in the film you write that you need to be a Jew by choice and not just by birth. And that is a spiritual process that people can slowly but surely have to develop within themselves, and for which there are no rules. You have to find your own way. Well, you say there are no rules, but I'm asking as a person with a much more traditional upbringing than you, are there any techniques as a religious person from birth can use to emulate the influence of a diverse background? I always wonder about the Amish Rumspringa and whether you think that has a place in Judaism.
I do think that if we would start with our Jewish education at home, in school, in yeshivot, differently than the way we do today, much of this could be conveyed to people who come from a religious background. I don't think it is so difficult. The problem is that when you get your Jewish education, your traditional Jewish education, you're already set in a certain order of thinking, which you really need to leave. And ask yourself about anything you do, why do I do this? Or why do I believe it? Because you have to rediscover which was given to you by your teachers and by your parents. You can't, as I say in the film, in the documentary, you cannot inherit religion. You can only discover it on your own. But it does require a completely different way of dealing with Jewish education, and this is not yet happening. Also, there are one or two yeshivot today here in Israel, which are definitely moving in that direction, which is absolutely great.
Your upbringing, your learning was in a very traditional environment. You spent 12 years at an ultra-Orthodox yeshiva. In retrospect, would you do that again, or would you have gone to a different type of yeshiva?
Very difficult to answer. I'm very pleased that I went to this ultra-Orthodox yeshiva in Gateshead. First I learned for 8 years in Gateshead, and then I learned 4 years here in the famous Mirror Yeshiva here in Jerusalem, which are definitely bastions of ultra-Orthodoxy. I don't think I would have liked to miss that, because it definitely gave me an insight into this world. The learning was fantastic. The teachers were outstanding. These people, still from the old country, were really Gedolei Hador, great people of these days. And their midot, their characteristics, were absolutely outstanding and deeply moving. From that point of view, I would never have liked to miss that. Obviously, it is a very boxed in community. There are many questions you cannot ask. I remember that I once challenged the Rosh Yeshiva by quoting one of the great German philosophers and asking him what he thought about this. And Rosh Yeshiva, who was honest enough, said, "I have got not the slightest clue what you are speaking about." I studied, because my father was a great admirer of Baruch Spinoza, and therefore he comes up in this movie, who had walked out, as you all know, completely and totally from the Jewish tradition. I always, till this day, I have him back in my mind, because I believe that the many questions and the many critiques which he wrote against the Jewish tradition has helped me actually to discover the Jewish tradition. Because only when you read criticism, Bikoret, on the Jewish tradition, you understand that you have to go deeper to really understand what this Jewish tradition is all about. If we are just living and moving in a world like in the yeshiva world, where everything is taken for granted as far as belief is concerned, as far as halacha is concerned, and you don't question it, then you don't get it. You just don't get it. That I'm absolutely convinced about. You have to question. You have to be critical. You have to say, why am I believing this? Why am I living that way? And then when you go back to our sources, you will see an unbelievable tapestry of the most beautiful insights. And that's which I think the general yeshiva, bachur or girl, is not able to get from the kind of education which they get at this moment.
Go a little bit deeper into that. So you write that today I believe that modern Orthodoxy too has for the most part become tedious. Even the famous Rabbi Joseph Ber Soloveitchik, head of the rabbinical school at Yeshiva University in New York, was not able to lift it out of its spiritual malaise. Conservative and Reform Judaism are not options for my soul. They are too easy, too academic, and unable to create a spiritual upheaval. My Judaism is one of dissent, protest, and a spiritual war against too much conformity. So in what way do each of these denominations get it wrong?
Some of them are too academic. I think that's one of the problems of modern orthodoxy. They perhaps give too much credence to the academic world without being skeptical about it. And as I said, that modern orthodoxy, and this is true about conservative Judaism and perhaps of Reform Judaism as well, is that it doesn't give the feeling of having to live for this, or for that reason, if necessary, to die for it. In other words, the commitment, which I find outstanding within the Haredi community, and that's the reason why I still have great respect for that community, the feeling I don't live for anything else than for my Jewishness and my serving God, this to me is outstanding. While in the modern Orthodox world, this is changing, by the way, for the better, no doubt, and there's a big difference here between modern Orthodox here in Israel and in Chutz La'aretz, there is a certain distance and certain feeling of this is not fair what I say, but it is getting close. It becomes a little bit what I call Coca-Cola light Judaism. And that I'm afraid of, because it won't survive that way.
In Chutz La'aretz.
In Chutz La'aretz, here it is definitely different. Here there's another problem, and that is the concept of politics getting into the Jewish traditional world, which is in itself a very big problem. Pardon?
Try from the top.
Oh, it's not working.
It's working. Just keep it close.
The red is off.
No, it's fine.
It's still.
You still hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Okay, sorry. I just said that I feel that we have to be very careful not turning the Jewish tradition in some kind of light Judaism, Coca-Cola light Judaism, as I call it, because we must inspire our children to live for this fully and totally with an enormous dedication. And the moment we get the feeling or we show them that we are not as serious about this as perhaps we should be, then we are sending the wrong message to our children and our grandchildren. I tell you an interesting story I wrote many years ago, and I got myself into lots of trouble because of this, an essay where I said that I wonder if I should not take off my yarmulke, my kippah. And I had very serious reasons for that, because in my younger days, when I went to a non-Jewish school, and I was not yet religious, but I got a little involved, I used to carry a kippah in my hand, in my pocket, which when I would eat my, at that time still non-kosher food, I would put it on, say a bracha, and eat. And the moment that I did so, I still remember this very clearly till this very day, I felt an incredible uplifting just by putting this kippah on my head. Because at that moment, there was a certain encounter with God, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I felt lifted up. I felt different. And it was a fantastic experience. And when I afterwards, after I'd eaten and said my Birkat HaMazon, or whatever it was that I said at the time, I put it back in my pocket. I was looking forward to the next meal. Why? Because I would have the experience again. Then I made a huge mistake. I decided, obviously, to start walking around with my kippah all the time, even in the school. And at that moment, I lost this experience because it became normal. And I'm still looking forward to the moment that I could take off this kippah again and only put it on when I do something religiously of greatness, of enormous intention, and then I have the problem. What will happen, as I wrote in this article, when my grandchildren see their grandfather walking around without a kippah? How am I going to justify that? Will they understand what it is and the reason why I'm taking it off only for one reason, and that is that I want to put it on correctly? They won't understand. So, my dear friends, I was, and I'm still caught in a dilemma here. I still walk around with it, only because of my grandchildren, because I would definitely take it off, at least when I'm under a roof, which is the halakha, when I would not be involved in something where I speak to God or anything like that. Because this religious experience is what I now miss tremendously and what made me into a very proud Jew. So this is definitely something worthwhile thinking about. Even when we don't take off the kippah, we should sometimes think about what would happen if I do, and then I put it back again.
I think the for me, the highest moment of the documentary is my Judaism is one of dissent, of protest, of spiritual war against too much conformity. There is a need for self-critique on many critical, crucial issues, not self-satisfaction. Not cliches, but insight. Not obstinacy, but elasticity. Not habit, but spontaneity. I struggle to understand how this fits in the context of a community. Does it create a nation of people that are loners? Or can you create a community around people that are in protest?
I think that the Jewish tradition is and should be a protest movement. And I think you can create a community around it. Not easy, because you have to keep the, let's say, spiritual level by which that is possible, and you can continue to do that. And that requires a lot of rethinking about what and how to do this, which is not now the time to discuss that. But I think it is absolutely necessity to do this, because otherwise we fall into the trap of getting used to being Jewish. And I can't think of anything worse than actually that. Let me add one thing here, which may be shocking to some of you. What I do believe is I am an optimist by nature. I believe that we will see in the next 50 years that some of the denominations which now are separated, such as Orthodox and Conservative, will move closer together. To the point, I would not be surprised that the modern Orthodox and the right-wing Conservative, if I can speak in these terms, will one day become one and the same. That they will become united, and that, I think, would only be a great blessing to all of us. Whether or not reform will go that way, I do not know. But I think we are going to see tremendous changes in the religious community around the world. Because on the end of the day, especially with the Conservative movement, we share more than where we disagree. And when we look into what we disagree about, very often are purely dogmatic matters. No doubt it's true that there is a different approach to halakha within the Conservative and the Orthodox movement, but we already hear voices on both sides, I'm quite involved in this, where they're coming closer and they're learning from each other, and there's a lot to be learned from the Conservative movement, as much as there's a lot to be learned from the Orthodox movement. And I think that even reform can play a role there. But the first thing what we need to do is to sit together and discuss that. As long as we constantly keep on building walls here, especially in this country, and our rabbis are not prepared to sit down around the table and say, okay, let's first of all agree where we disagree. What can we do about that? How can we overcome this? There may be some principles which we cannot overcome because they are too important to us. But at least we should be able to sit together and discuss that. And if we can't discuss that anywhere, while I am able allowed and I'm allowed to discuss anything with a priest, with the Catholic Church, with so many also Christian groups, and I'm not allowed to do that, and I'm not able to do that, this is the Conservative movement, I find that absolutely shocking and terribly disturbing.
Do you think that the modern Orthodox community is closer to the Conservative community than it is to the ultra-Orthodox one?
I don't know, because I think that is a matter which depends very much who you will be asking. First of all, I'm no longer sure what the word Orthodox means, and I'm neither sure anymore what the word Conservative means, because there's so many denominations within these groups that it's difficult to say who is the real one. And the answer obviously is that in a certain extent, there are so many versions of the Jewish tradition because we have no dogmas, as I mentioned in the movie, because we are basically a very open-minded but deeply believing community, that therefore there are definitely possibilities available which we haven't yet basically thought about, and that is a great pity.
Within this protest movement, are there boundaries to the ideas, both halachic and theological? I'll just throw out a few examples to frame it. Halachic, egalitarian or partnership minyanim, theological, biblical criticism in the divinity of the Torah, and philosophical modern values such as gay rights.
I think there's room, but there are also limits. These limits, by the way, also exist for Reform and conservative Judaism. Not everything goes. It's a complete misreading of Reform to say that everything goes. That may have been the case in the past, but it's no longer today the case. But I do think that when we start to look in, let me first speak about the theology of matters. The first thing to realize is that there is no Jewish theology. There is Jewish belief, but not a system of belief. The Yud Gimel Ikarim, the 13 famous faith positions or faith principles of the Rambam, are not representing what the Jewish tradition is really all about. If you know about its story of why they became so important and overwhelming, you will see that the Rambam never ever meant it to become a dogma as later it became. And the Rambam himself clearly didn't believe in all of them, or at least not in the way how he described them. So it is all open to debate. So theology is not a very clear-cut concept within the Jewish tradition. Baruch Hashem, very different from Christianity, where that dogma issue is much more profound than it is in our case. So that opens already up a lot of issues. When you speak about Bible criticism, because Maimonides at the time said that the whole of the Torah from beginning till end is Min HaShamayim, given at Sinai, we now accept that as the absolute truth about Orthodox Judaism. But as Mark Shapiro, if you are interested, wrote about in one of his remarkable books, the same Mark Shapiro, clearly shows that there was enormous amount of objection against the 13 principles by very great rabbis in the days of Maimonides and afterwards. And secondly, which is even more important, it was just published by Beit Midrashah in Hebrew here in Israel, a book which is called Ben Elokim LeAdam, if I correctly remember, where sources are brought that definitely it may have been that the sages later included certain passages within the Torah which were not originally there. It's clearly that is long from before Maimonides, written by deeply orthodox sages at the time who didn't believe the way as the Rambam stated it later on in his Yud Gimel Ikarim. Why the Rambam did that is obviously to try to make things easier for people to believe. You want to believe this, you want to believe that, so I tell you exactly what to believe. But the Jewish tradition doesn't work like that. If you ask me, is the whole of the Torah divine in the sense that God has a very deep hand into this, then the answer is yes. But it could have been via the sages, it could have been via the prophets, and not only via Moshe Rabbeinu. There are quite a few midrashim who actually make that point. So there is already a certain openness. It opens a door to some of the conservative approaches, which don't believe exactly in the Torah in the way as the Rambam does, which doesn't make it unorthodox in any way. And it is now only, especially in this country, where these things are coming about and where suddenly these things are being discussed, which was completely absent in the past for all sort of more sociological reasons than for any other reason. But therefore, I'm saying that there may be a moment when these two will come closer together. If they ever will become one and the same, I do not know, but I hope that at least they come closer because they have to teach us also very important things.
Let's move on to halakha for a second. Halakha seems to be really the focus of your philosophy, that things start with halakha. You write that the truth is that Judaism is a protest movement, an act of disobedience or rebellion. Avraham was the first rebel destroying idols. He was followed by Moses and the prophets. All of them turned the tables on the prevailing values of the times in which they lived. Eating kosher, celebrating Shabbat, observing the laws of sexual restraint, and going to synagogue are all protests against excessive consumerism. So where does halakha fit? What is halakha within this protest?
halacha is the art to live in total amazement every moment of our lives. And more than that, to know what to do with the amazement. Philosophy also deals with amazement. It's the point of departure of philosophy. It does not discuss what do I do with the amazement once it appears to me. Halacha is a response to that by telling me, like I said in the movie as well, that the moment that I eat an apple, I make a bracha because it is a statement of amazement. It is a wow. How do you translate wow in Hebrew? Baruch atah Hashem. And I see everything else from the same perspective, whether it is Shabbat, when it is Kashrut, whatever it is basically an objection against taking the world for granted and seeing the world as something normal. The world is a totally abnormal place, and there is no nation which is more abnormal than the Jewish people.
One of the greatest challenges of Jewish law, not me, you, is that it has to redeem itself from worlds that no longer exist. We need to decodify Jewish law and give it space to return to itself. What is decodifying Jewish law, and how do we do that?
I first of all speak here about the Shulchan Aruch, which was written by a great man, tremendous Talmid Chacham, more than that, one of the greatest sages, Rabbi Yosef Karo, who wrote at the time the Shulchan Aruch as a kind of kitzur Shulchan Aruch, as we have it today, to tell people how to live their lives, but it was completely focusing on Chutz Laaretz, on what was happening outside the land of Israel, when we had to live in ghettos, when we had to live in Jewish, small Jewish communities, and we had there to make sure that we were living more or less the same life so that we were able to hold up against the non-Jewish world. So therefore, there was a great need for codification, because codification creates a strength within a community. We're all doing the same thing. We hold all to the same minhagim, the same customs and so on. That creates strength to stand up against the non-Jewish world. And there was a tremendous need for that. So very right that Rabbi Yosef Karo wrote that at the time. And the same is true about an even greater codifier, a genius called the codifier, and that was Maimonides. The Codex of Jewish Law of Maimonides is an unbelievable genius piece which nobody's able to deal or to rewrite in any way at all. And he includes certain things related to the land of Israel, but on a purely theoretical basis. But also that doesn't work today anymore, because nobody, neither Maimonides or anybody else, has ever thought about a, let's call it, a Jewish secular state like we have it here at this very moment in this country. Deeply influenced by Jewish values, but not being run completely by halacha, but by other legal systems as well, and where the majority of the people are not yet religious. What do you do now, halachically? The only person who wrote, by the way, about this, this is a long story which I won't go into now, was the Rabbeinu Nissim, the Ran, in Spain, who saw this coming and writes about that in great lengths to find somewhere a modus vivendi, a way in between strict adherence to Jewish law and taking into account the secularity of the Jews at the time. And he's probably the only one who actually try to make that to happen, because he saw it coming up somehow. But it requires that we can no longer deal with modern Jewish life purely by only following the Shulchan Aruch, or for that reason, the Rambam. And you can see already that the later responsa are written by very great people in our own days. You see that they move away from these codexes, because the codex doesn't deal with problems as we know them today in our century, where we live in incredible circumstances which nobody ever could have thought about it would ever come about, especially not after a Holocaust, and only a few years later the state of Israel has been established. So this requires a completely different way, and I would say how less you codify and you allow many different opinions, the better it is. Halacha was put into a framework. It became in many ways stagnant. it became somehow not able to become itself anymore because of all the social circumstances of the Jews. But now that we're living in the state of Israel and things have radically changed, we need to change this also radically.
Okay. I have 3 hours more of questions, but we only have 5 minutes, so we're just going to open it up to people from the audience that have questions. Just one moment. I'm just going to say that if you do want to learn more about Rabbi Cardozo's writings, you can visit his website or follow him on Facebook. He's very active on Facebook. Or you can fill this out to get on his mailing list. And Rabbi Levenkreuz asked me to say that there's an interview with Rabbi Levenkreuz and Rabbi Cardozo on the Elmad website. Are there any questions? We'll do three at a time. Let's try that. So let's do one here. One of you.
How did your parents first react to you becoming observant when they had had this secular lifestyle?
We'll get three in and then.
Oh, okay.
I love what you say about. I love what you say about amazement and about protest and about individual discovery, but it also seems like, by definition, when you try to make something communal and passed down and shared, then it can tend toward the stagnant. So the question is, how do you inculcate that kind of amazement? How do you teach it to your children? How do you teach it to students? How do you pass it on and have it be shared across a community? How do you balance those two worlds?
Okay. Do you remember them?
Pardon me.
How is your relationship with your brother?
Very good. I'm very good.
How do you keep the sense of amazement on a cruise?
How was my parents?
I very much appreciate hearing how you define the word religion, religious. How do you define the word religion, religious?
Okay, very quickly. So my parents had a hard time with me. They were outstanding in the way how they dealt with it. I don't think they comprehended what was happening with me. They were too far away from that world, which I slowly was entering. My mother was extremely great about this. The first thing what she said when I made it clear to her that I wanted to eat kosher, she said, "We are not going to have a kosher corner in my kitchen. I will turn the whole of my kitchen kosher." That's exactly what she did. At that time, she was not Jewish. That took many years later, she became Jewish herself. I should also tell you something else, which is no doubt of interest. It's a pity that's not on the movie. My brother, married afterwards a non-Jewish girl, and that was one of the reasons why he ultimately did not become Jewish, because he was already friendly with her at the time. But they decided, and she was not at all from a Jewish background, to run a kosher home and their home so that I, my family, my parents could eat there. And they have done that for all the years. Later on, they left each other. But for all the years that they were together, they run a kosher home. I don't think there was anywhere else in the world a case where two non-Jews are running a kosher home. Perhaps they are, but anyway. But in Holland, I can tell you for sure it was the only one around. It just I just need to say something about my brother. My brother, in my opinion, it's good that he's not here, that he doesn't hear that, because he wouldn't like to, is a tremendous tzaddik. Is a very righteous person, and I learn a lot from him. He lives in Holland, I live here, but we often come together or we speak over the phone. He was here when the first time we showed this movie at the Beckin Center. I asked him to come over for that reason. And we had a very nice discussion at the time in front of an audience. He's an outstanding person. And I must tell you in all honesty that I feel a little guilty that I spoiled his life. In the sense that because I became an overwhelming power at the home of my parents, as my brother mentions in the movie, he didn't have enough of a space anymore. I was a kid still, I was 16 years old, 15 years old, and I didn't realize that, especially because he was all the time encouraging me to make this step. But I didn't realize what it did to him. Now that I look back, especially after he told me the story about the wine, and there are some other stories, or about, as he says, you hear how Jewish he is, he says, you know, I was used as the Shabbos goy at home, which I still remember clearly. We used to ask him to put off the lights and put them on again on Shabbat, because my mother couldn't do it, my father couldn't do it, and I couldn't do it. Right. But that was completely absurd. And it was deeply disturbing in the sense that that is how we used my brother. Not one of us, and I don't think he at the time realized this. But now that I look back into this, I feel very bad about this, because this is the last thing that I want to do to my brother. He understands that very well. We have had many discussions, and we keep a very close relationship. His children, who are quarter Jewish, they are incredibly proud about that quarter. They walk around with big Magin Davids, and they have even a tattoo of an amulet, a Jewish amulet on their arm. It's very strange how all this happens, and they know half of the brachot by heart, because when they came to my mother after my father died, my mother made kiddush, so they were there Friday night. They loved to come to their grandmother, so they learned how to say kiddush. So when I get my nephew on the phone, cousin Matthew, what is it, on the phone, and I say, oh, here is your uncle, he straight away starts with a piece of the kiddush to show him that, show me that he's still knows it. You know, this is very typical and obviously very unusual. I tremendously enjoy that, but I realized that there was also pain with all that, which I feel very bad about. That was question number one. Question number two.
How do you keep the sense of amazement?
How do you share it? Very difficult to answer this. There is no rule for this. You have to try to develop within your children, and first of all in yourself, a feeling that when you walk around, that whatever you see, whatever you observe, you are surprised about this. I can say the following. I look around here, and I see all your faces. That surprises me tremendously. When I look into the mirror, it surprises me tremendously. It didn't. You know, just imagine one thing. If somebody from outer space would ever enter into this world, extraterrestrial people coming here to this place, and they would look around and they would see us, what would they say about us? I think that they would say, who are these strange-looking people? There are a lot of pieces hanging out of their head, and this nose in the middle, and a big hole there where they put food in. And then they fall in love with each other? You know, how can that be? They look ugly, terribly ugly, by our standards. Not by your standards, not by my standards. We fall in love. How do you do this? This is totally surprising. Sexuality is totally surprising. I remember Winston Churchill once said, in one of his famous remarks, he said, I do not understand why God invented this way of creating babies. Couldn't he have done something else or come up with some other way? Because is that not extremely strange, how we create babies? It surprises me. And therefore, the moment that I'm able to convey this to my children and grandchildren, which I try to do, they suddenly, I see it in their eyes, they say, hey, wait a moment. Granddad is saying something there which we never thought about, we never heard about. And at that moment, some kind of small form of religiosity can enter when I tell them, that's the reason why you say a bracha. Just don't put some food into your mouth without saying first, wow. But once you keep on telling them that and you develop that within yourself, I think there is a chance that it may succeed. It may not always succeed, and it doesn't need always to succeed, but it definitely has an opportunity to make a point in our lives, which is extremely important. Last question was concerning what I mean by religion. I don't know exactly what to tell you. The word religion comes from the word religare in Latin, which means to see something in an unusual way. And so it somehow comes back to what I said before. It has all to do with amazement. If you ever want to read about that, read the great work of Abraham Joshua Heschel called God in Search of Man, which is an outstanding work, which is really an orthodox way of putting things together in the most beautiful poetic ways, where he has this concept of radical amazement, which I believe is terribly true about what it means to be religious. If you walk in the streets, when you put on your shoes or whatever else it is, and you sometimes ask yourself, why does the halakha interfere in everything and anything? Which it does. Which can be very disturbing. Then you should remember that the reason why it is to disturb you. The meaning of halakha is to disturb. The meaning of halakha is to upset you so that you will not take things for granted. And that's the meaning of religion.
Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi Cardozo. Many, many of your essays and writings are available on the website if somebody wants. And on Elmad, there's an interview with you. Thank you.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.